Hello, it's me, Jeff Norcott. This is a bit of a surprise, a pre-title sequence, but I just want to say, not a warning, but just a heads up that I've got Tom Walker, aka Jonathan Pye, on the show this week. And with so much news happening, we just launched straight into it, and it's absolutely brilliant. And he is, as you'd imagine, impassioned and funny on all the subjects. But for anyone expecting a gentle intro into this week's show, it's not going to happen. Hello and welcome to episode 144 of What Most People Think, and I'm going straight into it today. I mean, I've got a returning guest who's always been very popular on this show, Tom Walker, aka Jonathan Pye, as we christened you last time. How are you doing, mate?
I'm good. Is that the only reason you get me back? Is because it's popular rather than interesting or decent?
Well, it's both. It's both. Okay. I mean, I won't lie. If I showed you the graph, there's a good spike whenever you're on. I mean, the fact you've done it for three for a third time, I think is insane, but I'm going to keep, I'll ride this all the way to the bank. It's great to have you back on the show. And I feel like normally I like to sort of set the scene, but there'll be this, I don't know, maybe people don't want to talk about Partygate anymore, but we are talking in light of... So just to give you a context when you're listening to this, it's post the Boris photo, it's post the clips of people talking about the party culture at Westminster on Panorama, but pre-Sue Gray, okay? So that's where we are in the kind of multiverse of Partygate bullshit. And I suppose the first question... I mean, we really are going straight in there this week, Tom. I know that, like, in the social media world, everyone gets fucking, there is his fucking glass of wine, a prick. Does this move the dial as much for wider British society as it does Twitter?
I mean, I can only speak for myself. And for me, this means something. Do you know what I mean?
It move the dial, or does it take the dial back to that peak boiling point, if you know what I mean?
I think it's getting there. I mean, I think everyone in number 10, it's like, as I'm talking to you now, there's a really bad storm outside, and it does feel like that's coming directly from number 10. Do you know what I mean? And also the fact that there's just been these revelations today, all these people, Laura Koonsberg's just been interviewing a load of people that were there going, everyone was sitting on everyone's laps. Everyone was getting hammered. It feels like the BBC and the media are going on they can smell a bit of blood again. Do you know what I mean? But for me, my anger at this has never gone away. It's genuine, you know? Yeah. I think it's demonstrated everything that is wrong with Boris. I did a piece about this 6 months ago. Do you know what I mean? The horror of, you know, the Christmas parties and all this sort of shit, and it's still going on.
Well, but if you look at, like, this is what I take issue with some of these Tories that are sort of thinking, you know, the reaction to this is, you know, it's going to pass, people will get over it. But I think the damage is there. If you look at their polling, you know, you look at Boris's approval ratings, which did recover a little bit after the work that he's done in Ukraine. But I still think it could go a bit lower. But I just don't know why, I think what there is now probably is far too many people that would never vote for the Conservatives under Boris Johnson. That's what I think their problem is. I don't think everyone has deserted the Conservative Party under him, but there's some people now, and I might be among them. I don't know. I didn't vote for them at the local elections, but we'll see. And if you get enough of those people, you can't win power again. So surely they should do the pragmatic Tory thing of getting the old knives out. And it's just a question of practicalities at this point.
For me, without a doubt, and it's a no-brainer to me. It's funny, I was just thinking before I came on here, I remember asking you last time, who would you vote for? Would you vote for Boris if there was a general election today? And I was going to ask you the same question, but you're still kind of on the fence. But, I mean, Boris used to be their asset. Do you know what I mean? The Tories have never liked him. The Tories have never thought that he's good or he's adept as a politician.
Or one of them, you know, he sort of was an outsider within the context of the party.
But they could see that he had, a bit of charisma with the electorate. And let's face it, the last election, he spent most of his time in a fridge and he still won it. Do you know what I mean?
Well,
but he now has been, all of those you know, bumbling idiot, the amusing use of Latin, the sort of the slightly sort of cocky get away with it kind of thing. That used to be an asset, and now it's not. And the Partygate story, it's such a perfect story for him. This sort of image of him, you know, glugging champagne whilst we're all, you know, saying goodbye to our loved ones over Zoom. I mean, it's kind of, I think that's why it's hit a chord, because it's very Boris.
Yes. You know. Well, I mean, just for like the one of, there's been some amusing attempts to sort of downplay this, minimize, that's the new word, isn't it? Minimize, yeah. It was that he had in this photo is that he's got a red box with him, which meant he was doing work, which I just thought, I love the idea of that. I remember when I used to work in advertising, I used to walk around with like two bits of paper all the time, and I would just be going to speak to girls that I fancied all day, going around the sales floor. But as long as I had those two bits of paper, I mean, you know, it didn't, what is it? He could have been doing Charlie off the red box.
Easily. Boris Johnson could have been doing Charlie off his dispatch box. I think that's what we got.
It's a nice flat surface, isn't it? I mean, I'm not making that allegation at all.
I used to work in a hotel, and I used to spend 8-hour shifts walking from one end of the hotel to the other with purpose, with a tray, rather than doing work. You know what I mean? Just make it look. And I imagine he's very much like that.
Would you think he should have gone for the Bluetooth headset in as well if you wanted to create a full image of busy? I'm literally trying to dash. I mean, is there something? I mean, one of the things that's been pointed out was just like the birthday cake incident. This was something
that's what I love about it as well. There was an MP the other day, and they keep referring it to the birthday cake incident. You go, no, it's been proven that there's been widespread criminality across Downing Street, you know.
In a way that brings me on to another point, is that I think in this context there's obviously a wealth of reasons that he could or should resign without a doubt. You get 20 years on, like, if he does resign at this point, 40 years on, it will become harder contextually to explain why this happened. There's no doubt that the frivolity of the mantle that has been given of Partygate, it has played against the severity, like you say. I mean, you make the point. It's a genuine point. Beergate as well, obviously, to a much lesser extent.
I mean, that was interesting because, you know, obviously they tried to start a mudslinging thing. In one breath, the Tories are going, hey, it was an easy mistake to make, and the Prime Minister didn't know what he was doing. And then in the next, they're going, get Keir Starmer for having a beer. You know, it's like, well, which one is it? Do you know what I mean?
I suppose that they're kind of going, I mean, it's tricky, isn't it? Because there's definitely quite clearly a greater culture of this happening at number 10. Number 10 was setting the rules. You know, it's not comparable in a direct sense at all. But the only thing that brings it closer is the fact that Starmer rode such a fucking high horse for so long about it and told so many stories of, dying relatives. That is the only thing that even brings it into the same orbit.
But I think had there been Boris's birthday and they were in the cabinet office and someone gave him a fucking cake and blah, 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 and they got fined for that incident, you'd go, actually, do you know what? That's a bit fucking harsh. And we all trod that line, didn't we? A little bit. There were always there were a few occasions over lockdown, you go, I'm going to make a call on that. And do you know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely.
But what's clear about this is that it happened again and again and again and again. And you look at those pictures today and you go in there, you go, it's not a couple of bottles of wine. There's a half a bottle of fucking gin there. Do you know what I mean? And it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
A semi-depleted bottle of gin is a good sign of something that's gone quite all in, isn't it? I mean, that's the thing, is on the table. So there's either one or two things. There's a lot of where the Tories, either way, it's not good. Either all alcoholics, like savage alcoholics, and that's just a normal level of drinking for a situation like that. And then you think, well, if they did break the rules unwittingly, that means that they didn't understand their own rules.
Their own rules. Yeah.
Yeah. Or that they lied about it. I mean, I just think on a hunch, I think most people in this country, I mean, the podcast is called What Most People Think. Most people think there was a culture of this going on. And Boris, to varying degrees, has at best, been very manipulative with the interpretation of the rules. And at worst, has flatly lied repeatedly.
Well, like you just said there, he's got two options. I don't know why someone doesn't ask him this in these exact terms. It's you either didn't understand the rule, that these massive rules that
Theresa May actually
changing, you know.
Theresa May asked him that in comments. She said, which is it?
Yeah, no, you're right, actually. Give her that. And it's one or the other. You're either incompetent or you're a fucking liar. And by the looks of it, you know, I'm somewhere between the two. I think it's a bit of both. But these things sort of also, you know, if this government was, I mean, obviously it is. I am biased, obviously, because I fucking hate the Tories at the best of times, right? But if this was a decent government that hadn't criminally negligent in letting all the old people just fucking die, and if they'd have got this court, if Boris's oven-ready Brexit that he won a majority on the last one, promising to deliver this, stick it in the microwave, it's fucking done. You know, for him to 2 years later be turning around going, it's shit. Yeah, but you signed it, mate. You know, if they'd done some good fucking stuff, if child poverty wasn't through the roof, and this, I can go on ad nauseum, and usually I do, then a few drinks, I'd have gone, yeah, okay. But also it's his reaction to it. It's his instinct to lie about it and think he can get away with it. That means you are not fit for office.
Well, what happens is when I get, and it's great to see anime, but when I get, I'll get some people be a lot, and I've got a lot of left-wing people now that listen to a podcast. This will be music to their ears.
Well, that'll be me bringing that audience to you. So again,
I would say it's all advertising revenue, but it's not the way I do this podcast. I'm the worst fucking capitalist in comedy. They'll want to know why I didn't pull you up on a couple of things. So one is that he didn't let all the old people die. I should say some people were sadly allowed to live, and more than pity. you said it was you said stick it in the microwave. It was of course an oven ready deal. I would say with oven ready deals, they're only ever, the oven ready meals are partially cooked. So if in a true Johnsonian way, it could be said that in a way it was an oven ready deal, because
it was half baked, and some
of it would need to be finished in the microwave. That's what he meant. I just think people need to show a bit of latitude here. But I also would say, and I've said this on the last couple of weeks, is that I do think that there was a point in COVID where the government improved their performance quite dramatically, and the vaccine rollout, and and I think that they were right to take a bold shout on giving us our freedoms back. That does feel like a long time ago now. And also, I do think on Ukraine, whether or not it's played out as well in this country, we've taken a bold stance, you know. And I know that you've got strong views on the amount of Russian money swashing around. I mean, I would say they didn't get a very good deal, and they could legitimately ask for a fucking refund, because we seem to have taken a lead on the military front. How do you feel about what we've done in Ukraine?
Well, I just can't help think that Liz Truss is just doing it so that she can get that image of Thatcher in a tank. I think that's just what Truss is after, really, isn't it?
But is this the problem when you despise the Tories? Is no matter, we could literally, Boris could throw himself in front of a Russian missile. You go, well, that's a good photo op.
Okay, I mean, look, there are a few people in the Tory government that I can't imagine them. I mean, it's like a stopped clock is right twice a day, right? So there are, but there are a few people in that government that I just think I can't imagine you ever saying something that's worth listening to. Nadine Dorris, Boris, blah blah blah. But I do have to admit, when they do get things right, that the vaccination thing was impressive. It was a fucking gamble, and they were lucky. Mm. But you know, so they got that kind of right. I'll give them that. But also, I felt it was like with all the COVID stuff, it seemed to be actually the stuff where Boris just went, when he admitted, I don't really know what I'm doing here. I'll leave it to someone. You know, when they left it to the experts, it seemed to go okay. And actually, yeah. Again, opening up, again, it was a gamble that in the end, when they opened up, at the very end, when they opened up, that was a gamble that paid off. But they'd been opening up like once every couple of months. They were bound to get it right at some point.
Yeah. You know, I think that is more gracious than a lot of people that are as passionately left-wing as you would want to be.
Jeff. They're a bunch of fucking cunts, every single last one of them. Just for balance there.
Well, no, but what's interesting at the moment is you get, you know, and obviously you feel vindicated about this Conservative government and who they really are, but the issue is, I think a lot of people would expect Conservative voters to feel some sort of like regret about things, but nothing changes the option at the last election, right? So when I sit and think about what would have happened with COVID under Corbyn and McDonnell, I don't see a world where they work so closely with the private sector on vaccinations. I just don't see Jeremy Corbyn going, yeah, get the big pharma guys in here. I want to give them some contracts, right? Or, and I know that the PPE stuff attracted a lot of controversy, but the point of that was to just fucking
buy some.
Buy it. You know, even if we have to sort of burn it for heat in a couple of years because of the energy crisis. And then, you know, in terms of what Labour would have done in terms of, well, actually, when you think about Corbyn, I wonder actually, because he is like a freedom guy, like he's a Democrat. So I don't know. I think the Labour Party as a whole would have looked to lock down sooner, longer, harder, right? And wouldn't have come out of it as quick. I think Corbyn himself, I don't know. I mean, he didn't fucking shield, did he? He wasn't up for that. People of his age were supposed to not leave the house for a while, and he was still sitting there in the Commons, tutting.
Yeah, and just seeing what his brother was up to that day. Do you know what I mean? God, shut the fuck up.
No wonder he feels like he's actually quite moderate. When you look at his brother getting fucking rugby tackled by old Bill every Thursday, he must have thought, I'm actually a centrist.
Go on.
Well, look, we have got, and that's never happened on What Most People Think. We've launched straight in. And I think that was like, you know, one of those films that starts with a car chase. I think that was that. But we'll come back to politics in a while. Look, we should do some of the normal bits of the intro here. I mean, we've gone straight in. Good fun. But I should say hello to new patrons. If you're a VIP patron, you get mentioned straight at the top of the show. And of course, I don't know if you remember, Tom, we speculate on who these people are by dint of their name. And this guy's name is Mark Bennett. What is a Mark Bennett when he's at home? Mark Bennett
it sounds like a bully.
The Bennetts. The notorious Bennetts from around the way. They were a notorious family in Dunstable. Mark Bennett. He's always getting suspended.
Yeah. He did 6 years.
They just tried to keep him because actually he wasn't a stupid lad. So they just tried to keep him in just so he could get a couple of passes on his GCSEs. But he became completely fucking unmanageable towards the end.
And we're talking here sort of, this is kind of pretty typical of your demographic, isn't it?
I was going to try and go, you know, I've got all sorts of, look, it's pretty male, but also, you know, it's changing.
No, what I'm saying, most people that listen to this podcast have done time, is what I'm...
They have done time, or they know people that have done time, or they visited somebody in a prison. Yeah.
Or they want to.
So welcome, Mark. So if you join, I've just today uploaded an online gig I did a couple of weeks ago for Always Be Comedy. Plenty of content coming. If you like the fact that this doesn't have adverts, and increasingly is the last podcast that has a decent listenership without adverts, I'm going down this rabbit hole. Follow me and become a patron. Just go to the website, What Most People Think, and just type in Jeff Norcott. We have our super patron, David Demain. His talking point from last week's episode was about healthcare systems. So I was talking about how our healthcare compares, you know, against other publicly funded bodies. We're in the top 10, but we're 10th. Countries ahead of us include South Korea, Taiwan. Oh, that was it. I was saying, why do we spend more percentage of our GDP and have less doctors per head than Germany or France, right? So we do spend, I believe, a greater percentage of our GDP. So what's going wrong there? And the countries ahead of us are Denmark, Austria, Japan, Australia, France, Spain and Belgium. Although Belgium had a really shocking record in the COVID, didn't they? I don't know why theirs was so bad.
They weren't the ones that tried to just do nothing for a bit. Who was that?
No, Belgium were quite in a bit. No, Sweden. Sweden.
I mean, they're all the same.
You know. Sweden, fucking Nordics, Belgium, whatever. The fucking Nordics. I've never heard of it. So fair point there. So, I mean, we're in the top 10. That's not bad, but we could do with more doctors per head. I don't know if you've seen your doctor recently, Tom, but they've sort of become like local celebrities. If you spot them, they get papped. Yeah,
I mean, I have to wait 2 or 3 weeks for a GP appointment.
So, that's actually not the worst in the grand scheme of things.
But that's mental. I mean, like, if you were to go most places, I mean, most places, certainly in Europe, you could see a doctor the next day. I mean, like, to me, it's great. And I've never seen the same
thing. Is that true, though? Or I believe what you've just said, but then I suddenly go, it's like the fact that there are loads of food
banks. I have no evidence of that. It's just in my head. That's...
It's like the fact that there are food banks in Germany, and there's quite a lot. I just presume that food banks were the only ones, probably America as well. But turns out there are food banks in a lot of developed countries. And I instinctively would think the same as you.
Well, that's all right then. If Germany's doing it, then, don't know. Yeah,
we should have more.
Well, exactly. I think we're probably
more than the Germans.
Yeah.
So the other point, and this is another regular listener and patron, David Price. He made a point, which I'm going to call the price point. You see,
nice.
Got domain talking point and price point. We were talking about how people see themselves or primarily identify from within the UK. This is off the back of when I was on Question Time and some guy kept saying that Northern Ireland was in Britain. And I corrected him. But obviously when all the lefties shared that, they clipped me out at the end because obviously
let's go.
It doesn't really suit the Gammon narrative. But what he showed was the way that people, you know, primarily see themselves by region. And it's interesting was that in London, most people see themselves as British first. But the moment you get out of London, the rest of England is English first. I mean, it's such a stark graphic when you see it. I mean, there are a couple of areas where there's an exception, you know, Bristol, Brighton, other cities beginning with B. But in Scotland, obviously, you know, the amount of people in Scotland that see themselves as primarily Scottish has gone up from about 57% to about 72%.
Rather than British.
Yeah. Well, British first. So it's kind of Scottish first rather than... Doesn't mean they don't see themselves as British at all, but what do they primarily identify as? And this is one of the things I think Labour have a problem with is that it's hard enough for them to sort of be at ease with being positive about Britain. If they were trying to reconcile with being English, they would lose direct debits left, right and centre because plenty of all the momentum types would be like, what, this racism, this slide to fascism...
To be nationalistic about England is the last, you know, you can't do it. You can do it if you're Welsh, Scottish, Irish, Northern Irish. But if you're English, I mean, in fact, imagine waving an English flag outside your house when a football game wasn't on. You'd get shit through your door from the Guardian reader down the road. Do you know what I mean?
I think you've got a couple of weeks leeway before and after a tournament.
Yeah, and obviously with the Jubilee coming up.
Jubilee coming up. Well, what you might get is if you had a St. George's Cross hanging outside, people would also factor in how hard it was to take it back down again.
What most people think.
We do a thank you and a fuck you, which is just a piece of gratitude and a piece of bile. Do you have a thank you this week? Is something you're grateful for?
I was thinking about this. You mentioned it that it's something I'm grateful for. No one to thank really, but it did occur to me this morning. I was like, what am I grateful for? This sounds really awful, but I was just thinking this morning, I'm so fucking glad I've got some money in the bank because, right? No, and I mean it. And I don't mean it to be kind of like, I'm fucking loaded because I'm not, right? Yeah. But I spent a couple of decades, like proper poor, right? Like I know what it's like to go into Sainsbury's and have like £6 in your jeans and go, this has got to last me a week, right? Let's blah, 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 you know? And I'm just so fucking glad with all this shit that's going on right now. Because if this had happened 10 years ago, like, prices going through the fucking roof. I mean, I don't know what I'd have done, right? So I'm genuinely grateful that I am not impacted in the way that a lot of people are. Do you know what I mean?
You recognise that that's a privilege, that you've got to be a breathing space, I guess.
Yeah. I don't have to work 6 jobs and 50 hours a week to not be able to afford my gas bill, which is where millions of people are right now, and where I was a couple of years back. So it's like thank fuck for that. Yeah.
Well, Dad, I mean, it was just, we were saying just before we went on air that you finished the tour about 6 months ago, and you've had a good chill out since then.
I decided to give myself a couple of months off after that, and then a few weeks ago I realised, shit, I haven't really been working for 6 months. That's why everyone's like, why aren't you writing about this? It's like, I'm having a bit of time off, but yeah, I need to get back on the pie horse.
You seemed quite happy the moment we got on, and that normally suggests that you haven't been doing much within the world of comedy.
It's weird. I've got some gigs coming up, and and I'm not really, because like over the summer, the only real way to earn money gigging is doing like the festival circuit. Do you know? So I'm doing a few festivals, but so I'm doing Glastonbury this year. Sorry, I don't know how we got onto this. But it's kind of weird. Like so I'm doing the theatre and circus tent, right? Because I think they had a comedy tent, but they don't anymore. So I was headlining that last time, right? And this time round, because I'm not really part of the comedy world, I don't really gig, I don't really know these people, but suddenly on this gig list is like the Josh Widdicombes and the Nish Kumars and it's like, oh fuck, it's like they might watch me. I don't know why I'm like really nervous real, because in normal comedy terms, that's what normally happens, right? You have your peers, you do a set, and obviously the polite thing to do, I imagine, if you're gigging, is to like stick around and watch the rest of the gig, right?
Yeah, well, pre-phones, people used to do that more. Now they're just, you know, there's less chance of that. I get those nerves, because I did a gig in Cambridge Saturday just gone, and it was for Just a Laugh, and Tom, it was like Tom Davis and friends. So I know Tom, it's near where I live, so I went along and did it. But just a simple thing of him seeing me do stand-up live for the first time. Yeah. It scared the shit out of me, because I've been doing tour shows and you kind of go on, you can set your own tempo. Do you know what I mean? You know how to navigate certain things. Yeah. And suddenly I had a 25 minute slot where I had to go out and do like the 2020 cricket. So there was no forward defensives.
Yeah.
It was all, there you go, there's a cricket analogy.
Well done.
It was all heaving for the boundary, and I got really fucking nervous, man. So that's probably not what you want to hear. I've said, no, you're right to be nervous. I'm going to do the fuck you, and the fuck you is for... So when this news broke, right, of the photos this week, this is kind of like a sidebar to the Boris thing, but a lot of people were saying the same thing. A lot of the journos were saying the same thing, which was, as Dominic Cummings predicted, photos have emerged of the... I was like, sorry, it's him sharing them. It's him coordinating this. You don't get to say, as Dominic Cummings predicted, like he's some great fucking soothsayer. Dominic Cummings is got an uncanny ability to predict stuff he's going to do, like stuff he's already got on his to-do list. Fuck Boris even harder.
I haven't picked up on that, on that, that this was, and it makes complete sense the minute you say it. Of course it is. Do you know what I mean? Why has he waited until this moment?
I think he structured the reveals to see what comes. So if he doesn't feel like repercussions are strong enough, to keep building the pressure. Because obviously if he'd done it all in one dump, you know, you could navigate that hump. So it's been sort of expertly stage managed. And look, he's got his beef and stuff. It was just the fact that it made me wonder if he's said to these journos, one of the conditions of me giving you this information is that you've got to say, as Dominic Cummings predicted. because that is what he wants to be seen as more than anything, is some sort of oracle. But, you know...
Which is ridiculous, because he is the man who is directly responsible for getting Boris into number 10. So it's like, if you're such a fucking soothsayer, you know, and he's almost admitted, like, within days of getting him into number 10, he was going, what have I done? You know, he really should have thought it through, shouldn't he?
But, well, I think that, I suppose he thought, I get the impression he thought the Prime Minister could be more malleable. So he recognised his flaws, but he sort of forgot that there was a civil service and a party machinery that would be around, you know, because an election campaign is slightly different. They give you your head, you know, do whatever it takes to get elected. But then he sort of found, you know, he's found the civil service a bit of an issue.
But also, I think, you know, if Boris was in there, you know, quaffing, you know, champagne and, you know, banging Carrie and picking out wallpaper and whatever it is he fucking does. But everyone
all
around
three,
him,
all three,
all
at
three
once.
Of those. But if he was surrounded by competence and direction and a plan. I mean, you look at, like, for example, the cost of living crisis, right? I mean, I read yesterday Boris going, nothing's off the table. It's like, when are you going to come up with something then? You know, you know, when are you going to cut VAT or do fucking something? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, no, I absolutely think that. I mean, I've been leading a one-man campaign. I mentioned it on Question Time about cutting VAT. And so I don't want to claim the credit. Surprise, surprise. Cabinet briefing following day, we're talking about cutting VAT. So just so people know.
But to me, it's so obvious, not to pissing on your fire. But it's like, it's such an obvious, like,
I know.
You can fucking help people's pockets like that, like immediately.
Yeah,
overnight.
And it shouldn't be 20%. I mean, that's.
And also, like they're all, all the interviews I've been reading, you know, with these government ministers, in inverted commas, but it's like, you know, but long-term this, long-term that. He goes, that's great. You've got to be thinking long-term. But short-term, people can't afford fucking bread. So let's do some short-term stuff as well. Do you know what I mean? Like cutting VAT or...
Also, just on a moral point, so even if you take it out of the context of the current cost of living crisis... VAT should not be 20%.
No, it
should,
that's
it's really that fucking. When the tax was first introduced, I think it was about 3.5%. So it just shouldn't be.
I remember it being 7.5% or 8%. I remember it being that. Or it's 25%, but all other taxes are really low. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. That's your main fucking taxes. People buying stuff, we tax the shit out of it. You know, that could work, but 20% is mad.
I mean, it's so nebulous as well. Is like other tax, you go, income tax, you go, you get that. National insurance, it doesn't get used for that, but you understand the principle of national insurance. And then you go, value-added tax. It's such a...
Am I right in thinking that VAT is technically a tax on the business rather than the consumer? But it's a tax that generally seems to be...
passed on,
passed on.
Well, I've often said this, there are some government taxes that do strike you as a little bit mob, like mob actions, where like VAT is, it's the value-added tax.
Yeah.
You want to do business? 20%. It's going to be 20%. Well, you want to go, where else are you going to sell that coffee?
I'll tell you what, I'll throw in tampons and women's goods without it. There you go.
Look, we're nice guys. So baby milk, Tampax, bread. Exclude bread. Fuck, whatever.
Amazing.
So, all right, we're going to get into, well, I'll say the first main topic. This is more of a nebulous organic thing here. We're going to talk a little bit about the Labour Party. Okay, so obviously you look at local elections and polls, and, you know, certainly I think that as long as the Tories keep Boris Johnson, it would be very hard for them to form a majority. But I do feel like Labour are just sitting there waiting to win by default. They strike me as a boxer fighting Mike Tyson at the end of his career, who's already been bitten on the ear once, and is just thinking, I'll tell you what, he's going to fucking bite me again. I'll just let him bite me again. I don't think that is a strategy, because Labour have done this repeatedly. You know, they keep thinking, well, the Tories are just going to implode forever, and then somehow they pull it around. Now, maybe it's too far gone. But I think, and this is a question I was just interested in, what you think. What have Labour got to do to make people vote for them rather than against the Tories? What is it? Is it what they're doing? Is it just a slow trudge towards acceptability? I mean, how?
I think there is something to be said for not taking your foot off the pedal when it comes to pointing out the present government's problems. I mean, that is a reasonable path to power, because I think that there is some exceptional incompetence that has been going on, right? But I mean, I think Labour have, you know, the reason Labour are so fucked is Brexit. Do you know what I mean? It's fucked them. But what I would say is Brexit technically has been delivered, right? So that they're sort of off the hook there a bit. Do you know, in a way? Yeah. I mean, you know, the last election, it was still like, I mean, I think that's why the Red Wall collapsed, is because most of the Red Wall wanted Brexit, right? But that's done now. So I think Labour are at an advantage post-Brexit, but they need some fucking...
Well, Starmer is shit scared of being associated with being anti-Brexit, which is really weird, because he literally was the one that manoeuvred for a second referendum. And I actually think it wasn't so much how pro-Brexit the Red Rule was. It was the fact that Labour wanted to act against this democratic outcome. That was the real killer.
Yeah. But now that it's happened, he can't do that again. So what he can do is go, is you know, obviously, I mean, Boris is admitting that this Brexit deal is going to have to be kind of renegotiated, right? So it's sort of back on the table. It's like, so we can now have a discussion about, which always annoyed me with Remainers, that for 3 or 4 years, the discussion is about, well, should we have a Brexit or shouldn't we? You go, no, that question was answered on referendum day, right? We need to talk about, the type of Brexit. And I think, you know, had very early on, Labour started talking in terms of what is the best kind of Brexit we can deliver. We didn't want it, but now that you voted for it, I think they'd have recovered by now and we'd have possibly have a much better deal, right? But also they don't have anything, you know, there's nothing juicy on the table that is electoral gold, like doing something about tuition fees or something, you know, forgiving a load of debt. Or, I don't know, even fucking legalising weed or, you know, some big
But
fucking
see, that's
hitters,
the thing is, Starmer would never do that because he doesn't want to be. I often think is that the big fear is that you'll be on the front of the sun with a Photoshop spliff. All right, and it goes, Starmer, and they'll come up with some, but weed Starmer, it'd be a very weak pun. It would just be trying to associate someone with being a pothead. And actually, Starmer's probably less likely to do that than Boris, I would say. But they've been done. I think the media are broadly friendly to the Labour Party at the moment, so they've got a lot of ground out of a windfall tax, which really is just a fucking one card trick. It's literally a one off. I mean, here you go. Here's a few quid in your pocket. But that's what I wonder is how left wing can their policies be without scaring the shit out of sort of Middle England and the Red Wall, which is it's complicated, isn't it? Because the Red Wall. Actually, if you look at polling, they like the idea of nationalising each utility, trains, post office. All of them score highly. I think the question is that those voters aren't saying nationalise fucking all of them. Is it a case of picking two, you know? I mean, or just trains. I mean, would trains be a good one to say, like a really proper left-wing policy? We're going to nationalise the trains.
Yeah, I don't see why not. Or you go the fucking... take your pick. Do you know what I mean? The water board. We're taking it back, you know, or whatever, just something. You make the... Why not find out some left-wing socialist policies that are appropriate for the shit that's going on right now and push for them? Do you know what I mean? I mean, it's not the answer, but is the answer to the rising, you know, fuel and gas problems to... renationalise the gas and the, you know, have these fucking discussions. I mean, again, I think the idea of left and right is so sort of doesn't fucking mean anything anymore. I think what would serve Labour best is, you know, and I've said it a million times ad nauseum, is stay away from the social progressive policies and stick to fiscal.
Well, in a way, that is what they have done. And we'll come back to that in a sec. But it's worth saying that renationalisation of trains, I think, and a couple of other utilities actually scores quite highly among Conservative votes too. It's sort of like, I've got my own views on renationalisation, but it's fair to say that it's generally quite popular with the general public. Is it legitimate to worry that, you know, the worry that some voters might have is, you go, well, the Labour Party is still the same Labour Party that voted for Corbyn twice, campaigned for him twice in an election, is that this facade that they get together, you know, they go, right, let's get some sensible people on the front bench, because they had a few years where there were some fucking nutters, right? And let's get in your Yvette Cooper, you know, the centrist mother of dragons, you know, let's get in people. And yeah, they've got some good performers in there, like Wes Streeting, you know, and let's present that face. But then the voters go, well, once you get in power, will that be when the real battle for control begins and we have further moves on decolonisation of the curriculum, self-ID, for even more sort of ambitious targets for diversity and inclusion? Is that where they might come unstuck? Is that fear in the voters that they will... I mean, the Conservative Party themselves have been relatively... I mean, apart from things like, you know, immigration policy, they've been fairly woke, to coin a phrase... is that the Labour Party will just lurch left once they have the keys to the castle?
And it is a real danger. It is a real danger when Keir Starmer can't answer the question, you know, what is a woman? And you go, well, this is right at the forefront of the culture war. You better have your fucking answer straight by the next election. And one way or another, you're going to piss a lot of people off, right? I think...
Because people like Lisa Nandy as well, she's very strong on trans stuff. You know, she's very in favour of self-ID and the idea that, you know, a trans woman is a woman. So is Angela Rayner and stuff. So while, as I identified last week on the podcast, those concerns aren't big priorities for most voters, they're the kind of things that once you get into the sphere of a general election campaign... that could start to, it'd be easy to make them look ridiculous to a lot of the British public.
Yeah, on these sorts of issues, absolutely. But when Keir Starmer turns around and goes, I don't think this is the time or place for this sort of discussion, well, it's in the middle of a political interview about something that's political. And
a question that he should have seen coming as well. Like,
yeah, so it's not like it's, your... And also, it's a question designed to trip you up. Why have you not got a fucking answer? Do you know what I mean? And this is where it's going to come unstuck, because the right will always throw the left's tactics back at them. Do you know what I mean? Mm. So it's the left that attack the right wing for being transphobic. And then it's like recently when we decided to send all our immigrants to Rwanda, and then everyone, you know, which I happened to agree with people who were going, that's really a pretty abhorrent way to do it. And then they turned around and went, well, that's pretty xenophobic to say it's bad to send people to Rwanda. Do you know what I mean? That's anti-Rwanda to say that. Do you know what I mean? And how they turn our own language kind of... back on us, you know.
It was a bit affected, wasn't it? I mean, we have discussed this on this podcast, but they're sort of saying simultaneously that something that's supposed to be a deterrent, right, which would imply that you're going, well, no one want to go there.
When
people go, no one want to go there, you go, how very
dare you fucking racist.
Is it this is what I wonder at the moment, right? There's this idea that the Tories are in chaos, governing badly, and there's plenty of evidence to suggest that. But I wonder, with the volume of scrutiny on politicians now, the different ways that we can see what they're doing, you know, interviews, about the news channels now, I mean, new television channels, social media, is it possible now to govern? And this is what I wonder, is the idea that, you know, if we got the Tories out, we'd have this smooth sailing ship, sort of with Starmer at the helm, and there'd be no fuck-ups. But I don't know anymore if it's possible to govern smoothly because of the media environment. Now, it's not to say that people couldn't govern better, but you see where I'm coming from.
I agree with you. I think it's a self-perpetuating kind of thing whereby we are... So, and we all do it now in the age of social media. We are so quick to jump on someone who makes an error of judgment, or a slip of the tongue, or gets their facts wrong, or statistics wrong, or whatever, blah, blah, yeah. blah. And, you know, you can see that politicians never say anything in an interview because they're sort of trained to just, you know, and it's so frustrating for us, but they never answer the fucking question. They answer a different question that they've got a set answer to. But it's sort of self-perpetuating because if I was a politician, I'd be terrified to go on Good Morning Britain and have a normal discussion because if I say something wrong, it will be leapt upon. Do you know what I mean? So you don't say anything at all. And then...
It's a terrible job being a politician. It's a much worse job than it used to be. Like, because if you think back before the Commons was televised, right? You know, this old, you know, Sir Bernard Blenkinsop, you know, Ryslip East... Backbencher for 20 years, you vote on hunting, you do an interview, bit of campaigning, couple of surgeries a year, loads That's of it. Nice expenses. You don't have some clip of you on fucking like ye olde LBC going viral because you didn't know how much a musket was, right? And it's so unappealing as a job. And you know, the problem is we can't increase the pay that they get in this environment because the public will lose their fucking minds. You know, any extra media work that they do, you know, obviously there's a second jobs issues with the Tories. There's a lot of Labour people that have a very kind of high media profile. People like David Lammy got his own radio show. Yeah. I know there's worse things in the world to having your own radio show. But to me, that just suggests you're a bit of a fucking show pony. Whether it's left or right.
Yeah. I mean, but talking about second jobs, we've got a Chancellor of the Exchequer worth £700 million. I mean, that's...
But look,
and
he's still doing politics, Tom. That means he wants to make the world better.
Of course he does. Of course he does.
He could just be melting down his gold, you know, like, but he chooses to be there. David Lammy has to have an LBC thing. He needs the cash. Okay, just do a quick hype here. We've got some more patrons to welcome to the Patreon community. Everyone's got to have a community these days. We've got Stephen Fowler, who I'm afraid today does sound like somebody who did a heinous violent crime in the early 90s. Stephen Fowler, but there's been a search for, and someone was arrested earlier with blood-stained clothing found in their van.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Fowler just is Albert Square to me, isn't it? I mean, that's the Fowlers, the original EastEnders family. I don't know if he's related to Pauline and Arthur.
He might have been a Fowler. Do you remember when they did the story about Arthur being depressed? That was ahead of his fucking time, wasn't it?
Yeah, and he smashed I remember that. He smashed his living room up. That was... We all tuned in on Christmas Day for that. That was the 80s.
and then we forgot about depression for another 20 years. We're like, God, what it's like. Let's not talk about it. We got Tim here. Whenever we have a name without a surname, we have to speculate on what left-wing establishment he works in that he can't identify himself. I would say that Tim is probably working for... Who would Tim be working for? I mean, I think Tim would be...
Amnesty.
We've never had Amnesty. Yeah, Tim. Amnesty, but he'd also be one of those dodgy bastards that goes over to those countries and abuses his power and just shags around in fucking civil war zones.
Yeah. Oh, Jesus. I'm glad I'm not Tim.
Then he comes back to Britain and then boasts about the humanitarian work he does and he gets more shagging out of that. Tim's a legend.
Yeah. Riddled as well, Tim.
Riddled. Adam Blenkhorn. Is that German? Adam Blenkhorn? He sounds like a right back for Borussia Dortmund, doesn't he? You find out that he was born in England, you go, fucking. He could play for us, but he's not that daft. Well, welcome one and all to the Patreon community. I've got last remaining tour dates this week. I mean, why can I never remember this? I mean, Maidenhead Friday, that will probably be sold out by the time this gets uploaded. Spalding on Saturday, that very much won't be sold out by the time this goes up. And then on Sunday, the last day of this tour in Wimbledon Theatre. We've got loads of tickets sold, but it is a big venue. Do come along. And then I'm at Edinburgh Festival, and it's going to be this tour show, but I'm going to zhuzh it the fuck up. There's going to be loads of new... Well, the Tories would have just done more stupid shit, won't they? I mean, that is...
Do you normally do Edinburgh? Have you done it?
I do a couple of weeks for me sins. I just think this is the best show that I've ever done. And all the years that I've put in taking really, like, I took one show to Edinburgh that the critics liked, which obviously meant it wasn't funny. Yeah. I took one show that was really funny and the critics hated. And this one, I don't care what, I'm not going to invite any critics. I just think it's a good show.
So, yeah, it's really strange. My last show that I did is like my proudest kind of. I fucking loved that show. And it's kind of weird now because you kind of go, well, I can't tour it again.
I know.
You know, and you just go, like, all of that material that took me, you know, because the tour got, you know, shut down halfway through because of COVID. And then 2 years later, I revisited the same script and made it. In my, you know, it was really nice to revisit a script and like kill a few darlings and go, let's tighten this the fuck out of this. And now you just go, it's done now, isn't it? Do you know what I mean?
It's weird. I've never thought that before this tour. And I think that it's what the good thing about writing books, you write a book, it's just there. It's like a performance that somebody does for you. They actually do the read in their own
brain. Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
It's so that's why I'm trying to get another book away.
Well, yeah, I see. Yeah, we should write one together. That's
We should do stuff together. It's always, you know, but that's what happens whenever we do the podcast. People go, "You should do stuff together." You just fucking did. We did a whole hour here. And obviously, all Jonathan Pye stuff, whether it's on YouTube, whether it's on TikTok, fucking MySpace. Friends reunited.
MySpace. Yeah,
don't know. You know,
I am apparently on TikTok, but I don't have a TikTok account. But so people just TikTok on my behalf, I think.
Well, don't look it on TikTok. Go on YouTube or anywhere that Tom can actually make some capital out of this. Yeah, don't look it on TikTok. Some 17-year-old prick making money out of Tom. Go to YouTube. All right, just a quick subject here. I mean, I want to talk about the cultural mood. In broadcasting, like television and comedy and stuff. Because I just wondered, after years of, you know, sort of right on or woke thought seeming to be taking hold in comedy, are there signs that it's going back the other way? And the reason I say this is that the head of Netflix recently said maybe the staff aren't the best people to decide what should be in our comedy specials.
Yeah.
It's a revolutionary idea. The Channel 4 boss came out in support of Jimmy Carr after the joke about the travelling community. There's been a couple of shows that I've really enjoyed, called Hacks on Amazon Prime, which is about an older comic and a younger writer. And there's a real contest of ideas in it. There's also Chivalry with Steve Coogan, which represents kind of like, the views of the dinosaur and the young director. And I just thought, have they realised, Tom, that comedy is really hard when you're trying to hashtag be kind? You know, it doesn't mean you have to be mean, but do you sense that in the wind, that things are changing a little bit? In comedy, I mean, not in other stuff.
Yeah, no, I think there is a bit of a shift. I think, you know, for several years I was there flying the flag for, you know, free speech in comedy, and I didn't get much truck in the comedy world for it because there used to be, and there still is, this sort of idea that if you go, I'm defending someone's right to tell a joke that I find unsavory, that you must kind of condone the joke. Mm. I think it's really interesting that Netflix didn't sort of bow down to pressure because of the, you know, with the Chappelle thing and also with the Carr thing. You know, there were calls for it to be taken down or to be edited. What I found really interesting about the Jimmy Carr thing was all these... you know, all these newspapers, when they were reporting it, they were always putting joke in inverted commas. Jimmy Carr tells offensive joke, as if there was some sort of debate about whether it was a joke or not, because people were saying, well, it wasn't funny, so it's not a joke, or, you know, and the context is he is a comedian. It's a Netflix special. Yeah. And some audience are laughing, and he has set the joke up as, this is the worst thing you could possibly say under these circumstances. I mean, he's aware of what he's kind of doing there. I'm really happy to debate whether the joke was appropriate or offensive or stepped over a line or whatever, but I'm not going to sit and debate whether it was a joke or not, because it was a fucking joke.
But that's the point, isn't it? For them to have the conversation they want to have, they have to pull it away, because they know the truth. The joke is not as doesn't have as much gravitas as serious things, as real life. It is a joke, but then what they have is a feeling, And they just want to visit some of that feeling on you. So they have to essentially be manipulative by pulling it out of context. And it's interesting we have this chat today is that Ricky Gervais's special has gone up. And now this might be a thing with Netflix specials, as with Chappelle, as with Jimmy Carr, is that bit by bit some stuff will emerge that some people find contentious. And he's got a routine, what I would call some fairly spicy stuff on trans. I think it's very funny and it's very bold. And there was a review in The Independent which gave it 2 stars, obviously.
Of course, yeah.
And then the guy reviewing it said that, you know, he still sells out. Many people will be baffled that he still sells out arenas and has globally successful television shows. And I thought, look, success in itself isn't proof of something per se. But if fucking shitloads of people really like something, especially as something as kind of individual as comedy, he's good at it. Like, people him. It speaks for itself.
I found it really interesting when Louis C.K. got done for being a pervert, right? And there was, about a year later, he started gigging again. And for a start, he started gigging, and one of his very first warm-up gigs was recorded. Right. And there was a joke in it about a school shooting where he said the best way to get out of to survive a school shooting is throw a fat kid in the line of fire. Right. Which I found was funny. Right. Because it's clearly the target of the joke is the nonchalance and the normality of kids being shut up at fucking school, right? And you had all these articles going, Louis C.K. mocks victims of school shootings. You're like, again, it's the same thing with the Jimmy Carr joke in inverted commas. It's like, why are you deliberately misrepresenting a joke? Because you don't like a particular aspect of Louis C.K., which is unrelated, but clearly vile, right? He likes wanking in front of women. But why are you not telling the truth about...
He's mocking fat kids.
And I looked up the Guardian's review, the last review of Louis C.K. before he got done or exposed as this, and it was 5 stars. He's pushing boundaries. He's always on the nut. Blah 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 blah. And then the review after that was like, he's doing the same old shit that he's done for years and blah blah blah. And it's like, just be honest about it. Okay, yeah. Is it good or isn't it? Or, you know, like you could say about Ricky Gervais, you like, you know, well, certainly by now, if it's not going to be to your taste, why are you watching it? Do you know what I mean?
Well, that, I think, is what's changed the landscape, is that when comedy was essentially foist on people, it was, you know, it's terrestrial. You could make arguments about whether or not you were being subjected to it, right? I still don't think that you were as such. But like with the podcast download specials on Netflix, there's an element of selection that really changes the game more than anyone's willing to acknowledge, is that people are buying into this, right? Yeah. I mean, I suppose you will eventually have the equivalent of the, I don't pay my license fee for this rubbish, of people go, I don't pay my Netflix direct debit for this rubbish. But the fact that you select to watch it means, for me, that gives even more artistic license to the comic, because they're sitting there, they don't have to be watched.
Yeah. It's also like with me, when I put stuff out online, like the normal YouTube-y stuff, I write it differently because I'm aware that you can stumble across Jonathan Pye stuff on Facebook, right? So I'm not going to be calling everyone a cunt, and I'm not going to be saying things that are deliberately provocative or contentious in the main. Whereas if I'm on stage and you've got people have paid 20 quid and they're in that theatre, and that contract, it's an implicit contract that you've got with that audience that you don't have, say, with an online audience, you know. And it's the same with Netflix. You go, there's a contract there. You've pressed play. Do you want to watch this? Yes, I do. Warning, can take. Yes, I still want to watch it. You've entered that contract, right? So I think you're absolutely right. You know, if you were doing writing a special that you knew was going to go out on BBC One at 10 o'clock and people would just kind of stumble on it, you would probably take that into account. You know,
can you imagine the oversight of a comedy special on BBC One now? If the meetings, I'm not even sure. I mean, like, I don't know, when I did Live at the Apollo, they weren't actually, in fairness, they didn't have, I suppose it's perhaps done through the booking, right? So you book comics that are liable to say certain things. But I did stuff about concentration camp and stuff, and they didn't say much to me. They didn't say anything at the time.
It's funny. My second show ended up on the BBC, and there was a joke right at the start that was kind of important because I referred back to it later in the show as going, do you remember that offensive joke I told at the start? And it was a riff on some of you were offended, some found it funny. That's what comedy is, kind of thing. But it was a joke about Jill Dander and how Pi suspected that it was Fiona Bruce who had taken a hit out on her, right? And it's extreme, but it's funny. But it was quite offensive. But then I later went on to kind of go, well, you know, that was kind of the point I was making. And the BBC asked me to get rid of that joke. And I thought, do you know what? There are people in that building that worked with her. I'm perfectly happy to cut. And it meant a bit of an edit because it meant that a callback didn't quite work. But I went, do you know what?
Yeah.
That's fine. And the only other thing they asked me to edit was I did this riff on Margaret Thatcher. And because I am a genius political satirist, I ended it with it going, Margaret Thatcher, and I'm glad she's dead. And it got a round of applause. And what they objected to is not me going, I'm glad she's dead. It was because everyone was like, yeah, like that.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
That doesn't sit well with us celebrating. You know, she is a British icon, no matter what you think of her. So I was happy to do those cuts. But other than that, actually, they were pretty. But that was 4 or 5 years ago now, and I don't reckon they would have allowed it.
Well, I mean, this is one of the things I'm wondering is if the lockdown period was perhaps where these sensitivities surged, and whether or not the fact it's plateauing again now is because people are back out in the real world. So if you think you're quite a sensitive, snowflakey type, and you know you're able to just plow down into your own sort of cultural silo during lockdown, where no one thinks it's weird that you drink sort of 7 different kinds of milk, right? Yeah. And then you get back in the office and there's someone that gives you a bit of light ribbon and goes, what's that, fucking wasp milk? You know what I mean? You might not enjoy that, but at least it exposes you to the idea that not everyone thinks that having 7 different kinds of milk is you know, or you might have a conversation about Meghan and Harry where you realise someone doesn't like them, but it's nothing to do with racism. Whereas that bit... That bit of lockdown, I do think that culturally it affected a lot of stuff. It ticked up. And then I think, this is what I think, money talks, bullshit walks. What happened was people that make comedy and stream it went, we can't put good comedy out if we can only take the moral high ground because it's not funny. And if you continue to take the moral high ground, you're more likely to be the subject of the joke than anything else, right? If you think about you, that's funny. Taking the moral high ground is funny in itself. So the market decides, I guess. I've come all the way around back to a right-wing point and I think that you should be grateful to capitalism for free speech. does that argument hold together in any way? It doesn't matter. Let's go on and do some letters.
It sounded good. It sounded good.
I said to my VIP patrons that you were coming on the show. A lot of them had questions they wanted to ask you. We've only got time perhaps for a couple. Why does the left believe they have the moral high ground? Short answer. You can disagree?
'Cause in their hearts they do.
That's from John Winter.
Whereas all right-wingers are ice cold,
killers.
Killers.
I think in my own personal experience, right, left-wing people are nice in theory, right? So if you talk about what should you do for people in theory, they're fucking great people. What they do for people in actuality, whereas right-wing people, and this is true of me to an extent, I'll often take quite a harsh, punitive, take some responsibility tone. But actually, in the way that I organise my own life, I'm sort of the earth, mate. You got a problem, I'll be round there.
I sort of agree with you there, yeah. I mean, I think... I mean, there are two different types of left-wingers, aren't they? But, I mean, obviously, I think we associate more with that middle-class, guardian-y left-winger as opposed to that down...
I mean, all of my comedy basically comes from there. Presumption.
Exactly. You know. But, you know, the old-school lefty used to be down the mind, you know what I mean? So, Yeah, I don't know what my point was there.
Well, I'd say that the left winger, the socialist that was down on mine, did have the moral high ground.
Yes, yeah.
But the guy who sends his kid, you know, to a mostly white faith school in Islington whilst railing against grammar schools does not. Okay, there's another question here. Andy Hempstead. It's quite a long question, but it might be a short answer. Who does someone like me vote for when the Tory party is now taking more tax than any Labour government did, who are economically mismanaging the economy, run by liars and people like Rishi, who couldn't see that non-dom status of his wife would play badly, when the Labour party is arguing that taxes are too high, yet couldn't vote for Labour, as obviously is the party full of people who hate this country and despise the working class voter like me? Who does he vote for?
Green. There is a really good, and I recommend it highly, when there's a general election, there's a really good website called Vote for Policy. And I've used it a lot, and I've done some stuff with them trying to push people to do it, because people are on the fence. And what you do is it's a questionnaire, and you can either do like 10 questions, or you can go into all various subjects, answer 100 questions, and it will tell you, based on manifestos, who you should kind of be voting for. And if ever you are in doubt, just I would do this Vote for Policy thing. And then, because if you don't...
But how do I know that's not being run by dark money from some woke billionaire? Eh?
It could be. But I've used it, and it's a very good way of doing it. If not, I mean, what I would always do, which I always tell like young people, is like, for Christ's sake, register to vote and then just spoil your paper. I mean, the amount of 19-year-olds I've told directly to go to the voting booth and draw a big dick on the ballot paper, because you're still exercising your democratic right.
Yeah, no, that's what I did at the locals. Pussied out of drawing a dick in the end, which was an interesting sentence. And also, I have to say, like, that it encapsulated the problem for the Lib Dems there. I spoke to you about a guy that's disillusioned with between the two main parties, right? All the Lib Dems, all seven of them, they're sitting there going, us, surely us. And you went, Greens.
Yeah.
Tom Walker, thank you so much for making a welcome return to the show. People always love it when you come on. As I said, you know, check out all of Tom's social stuff. Is there anything else they should be going to in particular?
My live show that I was talking about, which is my favourite thing I've done, you can go on my website, you can download it for a fiver and watch it. So, jonathanpye.com. Please, you know, check it out.
That is very good value. It was absolutely barnstorming show. Mate, thanks for coming back on the show again. Hopefully have you back soon.
Pleasure. Yes, of course. Anytime.
And that is it for us this week. We'll be back next week with another interview. But enjoy your week, you know. And if you are in politics and you are going to do something against the rules, just make sure no one's got a fucking camera.